question. So some of you are involved in mindfulness practice, meditation practice for a long time. Some of you for a short time. Some of you are involved in a spiritual practice. Some of you have, out of your life experience or whatever, you have some deep-seated knowing or belief about life or reality or what it is to be a human being. So the question is, what is it that you hold to be most true? What is it you know to be most true? In the realm of spiritual practice or mindfulness practice, what do you know to be most true? And then the interesting question is, once you've kind of get some sense or you know what's most true for you, is upon what authority? What's the authority or the evidence for you knowing that this is true? On what authority or what evidence do you know this to be true? And then, are there any assumptions that go into knowing this truth? Some article of faith or assumption connected to this knowing. And now I'd like to switch the topic of reflection. And for you to think back to an earlier time in your life, to the beginning of your involvement with maybe meditation practice or spiritual practice, or maybe you were involved in some kind of religious tradition, Buddhist or other. Remember back, were there some assumptions you had about what a practice life, a religious life, a spiritual life was about or is about, that you no longer hold to be true? Were there some assumptions back then that you've outgrown or seen through or no longer see as being valid? How was it that you came to see through these assumptions? What happened to you? How did you learn to realize these assumptions were not valid and you could let go of them? And letting go of that reflection. And the final one is to think a little bit about whether there are assumptions you carry now. What assumptions underlie your practice life, your spiritual life, your deeper understanding of reality? And how might you test these assumptions? How might you find out whether these assumptions are valid or not valid? In the Buddhist tradition, there is a tradition or a time-honored practice of reflection and of thinking and contemplating about different themes and about our life. And a lot of Westerners sometimes think too much about their lives. And so sometimes you go on retreats and you're mostly told, you know, don't think, you know, just practice quietly. But thinking in a contemplative way, kind of deeply about our life and ourselves and what's going on in the world, is a very important part of a Buddhist spiritual life. And you see it in enshrined in a very important list. So a lot of lists in Buddhism. And it's called the Four Factors of Stream Entry. As the people mature in a spiritual life, there's a particular stages of maturity that people go through. And one of the first major important kind of stages of maturity, spiritual maturity, is one that's called stream entry. And there's a list of the four factors that support or the conditions that make it possible to attain stream entry, become that maturity happen. And the first of these conditions is having good friends, good spiritual friends. So right now we all have that. It's very nice. We're kind of, you know, have sitting with people somewhat like-minded. And the second is to be able to listen or read, back then in the old days, listen to the Dharma, to the teachings. And hopefully you have that. And we have a lot of different teachers that come through here at our center. And hopefully some of them, you know, have good teachings. And so listen to the teachings. And the third, which I'll skip for a moment, the fourth, is to practice the Dharma according to the Dharma. To practice according to the Dharma. So be engaged in practice, like mindfulness practice, practice of ethics, and generosity, and wisdom, and, you know, a whole series of practice in Buddhism. To practice, to do something, be engaged. The third, so that also, a lot of people here, we do that. We sit here, we practice. So these first three conditions that I mentioned are all kind of fulfilled by many of us. But the one that I left out is the one that I think is probably the weakest in our tradition. And that is to reflect, to have wise reflection is a condition for stream entry. To have this wise contemplation, wise thinking and engagement in a thoughtful way, contemplative way about different things, about reality, truth, our life. The Dharma, to engage and challenge the Dharma. You hear certain teachings. And then to engage with it in an active, challenging, serious way, you know, what you think about this. So reflective practices are important. So I offered you some reflections during the meditation time. And what I'd like suddenly changed. It's changed, the speakers? So suddenly there was a little change over in this side of the room, maybe. What I'd like to do this morning is, before I prejudice you any more with ideas, I would like to suggest that you form little groups of four, maybe five people. And discuss what arose for you when you had these reflections, when I offer you these reflections. And what your reactions were, what thoughts, what reflections you had. boy, scratchy. Turn that speaker. Can you turn that speaker off? I think it's that speaker, isn't it? Or the speaker out in the hall? Does anybody have a sense of where the problem is? Is this speaker here? Is it possible to turn just one speaker off? Okay, be patient with me, because I'm going to stop really soon. So you'll do that for a few. So we'll form little groups of about four. I think four is a good number, but it could be five. And discuss what came up with it within each when you did the reflection and meditation, and then be careful with the time. You have about 20 minutes. So make sure that you all have a chance to speak. One person doesn't dominate. And then we'll gather together as a group, and then we'll continue, and I'll say some more words and give a very short dharmette at the end. And for those of you, some of you came and missed the meditation part, so your group can tell you what the questions were, but I'll repeat some of them. there were basically three categories of questions. One had to do about what do you know as being most true in your spiritual life, if you use the word spirituality, or your practice life, or you know, or your philosophy of life in general. What do you know is most true? And upon what authority do you hold that to be true? What evidence do you hold that to be true? And this is a very important issue in Buddhism. The Buddha addressed this issue a lot. Upon what authority? How do you know something is true? Really, you know, Buddhism kind of challenges that over and over again. So in a sense, by doing that, it challenges itself. You know, Buddhist teachings. How do you know Buddhist teachings are true? And you're supposed to be really, you know, explore this topic, not to take it as an article of faith. So, so what do you most know to be most true? And upon what evidence do you take it to be true? What basis do you take it to be true? And then, in the past, when you first got involved in the spiritual practice, or somehow in the past, were there assumptions about life or spirituality which you no longer hold, that you have seen through? And how do you see through it? And then, are there assumptions in the present that you hold about life, about spirituality? And how might you test it? How might you find out whether they're true or valid or invalid? These current assumptions that you hold. So you don't have to address all of them, but whatever seems juicy for you as a group. Maybe as you talk in your group, maybe kind of bundle up close so you can talk more quietly so the room doesn't fill with a lot of people talking at once. It gets kind of noisy that way. And then we'll regather. So please form your little groups. It might be nice to have a few comments about what that was like, to do that reflection and have the discussion. Yes?
I just want to say that I take it that deepened my contemplations and discussions, but I think a lot of things people said in our group touched on things that maybe I was able to really consciously recognize when someone said something like.
Speak a little bit louder. Great, thank you. Sorry, yeah, resist. So Kathy had resistance to doing it, but then discovered how helpful it was to do it. How many of you felt some resistance to the idea of forming groups and talking about it? And should I have, recognized that you were resistant to doing it and kind of left you alone to listen to a regular Dharma talk? I should have. Yes, next. Someone else? So, well, you had a lot of talk about in your group. Suddenly, you're quiet. So I'm not going to, I'll just stay ignorant in the dark about what that was all about. Yes.
Our group was we started talking about what we felt might be the answer, and love, of course, and compassion, and maybe the difficulty of even finding an answer, but what we ended up with, or one of us mentioned connection with other people, which is, I think, a nice way of bringing all that together, because even if you don't come up with some huge truth, just the connection that you can feel with other people may be all you really need. It's kind of where the bell rang and we stopped.
Yes.
Well, I felt
found in our group, we maybe didn't cover a lot of areas, but the things that we did talk about, we seem to be coming to the same place, but we all seem to have started off somewhere differently, and yet it was kind of felt like we were kind of merging in some of the things we were talking about, that coming toward each other. And I thought that was interesting to see.
Nice.
Group, the conversation seemed to move towards what was it that brought us to practice? It seemed like just these questions, and just this looking at what is the authority that we're looking towards, seemed to be what really attracted most everybody in the group to coming here, and also the whole finding Sangha to support that. Also a common theme.
Yes.
Well, many people in my group are relatively new, like just the last few months. So I think the idea of community, that really feeling a part of, was enormously important. And also hearing each person's thoughts was like a crystal. The light of each thought of experience, and together that seemed to create a bigger light and shine a little brighter.
I posed these questions Friday to a group of people, and one of the groups of people that this question got posed to was a group of five other Dharma teachers, and so we sat together as five or six, you know, six of us sitting around in the circle discussing, you know, our own takes on this question and how we responded, and there were a few different things that people said that I want to share. One was among his teachers. One was, in terms of assumptions they had early on, it was one of the several people said that they had the assumption that they had to become like someone else. That they had met some teacher or some great practitioner, and they thought, well, that's how I'm supposed to be, just like that person. Once I kind of get, you know, some attainment or develop myself in practice, I'll be just like him or her, you know. And then they realized that was not a valid assumption, because that was just their personality, and you know, they had their own personality, and they're going to have their own way of expressing their own spiritual maturation. The other was the idea of some kind of purity, that if you practice, you're going to be able to get rid of all these terrible things inside of you and become, you know, morally and spiritually completely pure, shining light. And a number of people said that was kind of burdensome assumption they carried, because built into that assumption was a lot of aversion and feeling of kind of unworthiness, that they had to somehow make themselves more worthy. I don't think in the time that's remaining I want to give much of a talk on this topic, because I feel like I just, you know, I need much more time. Maybe next Sunday I can give a talk on this topic and my thoughts about it, and much further. But I wanted to maybe give you a couple of since it's you all are sharing somewhat personally, something a little more personal about from my point of view about these kinds of. I'm for Buddhism would say karmic reasons, for some reasons or other, I'm keenly interested in the question of the authority or the evidence or the basis by which we hold certain beliefs and ideas, and to always kind of be searching for the underlying assumptions, and not to kind of be complacent about what I know to be true or what I teach, but to always be looking, are there assumptions here that I haven't really understood that underlie it, and from what evidence do I know those assumptions to be true or not true, whatever. And part of the reason, is it, you're okay with the sound? You're willing to put up with it? I'm a little bit distracted by it, but I'll Partly I'm distracted because I'm concerned you're going to be distracted. I mean, if I'm reassured that you're fine, then... I wonder if... Am I speaking to... My undergraduate degree is in agronomy, which is the art and science of field crop management. So in other words, an ag degree from UC Davis. And a little bit different than how I ended up. And I was kind of chastised is the right word, but I was very sobered or very... the experience was very important for me in how I'm relating to Buddhism. Because I went to UC Davis as kind of a fundamentalist organic farmer. And I was a born-again, you know, organicist. And I was an agricultural activist on campus. And I did a lot of good. Some of my friends and who are also fellow students, we did some interesting things that still continue at Davis as a legacy of our work back then. So we're kind of an agricultural activist, alternative agriculture. But I had various ideas about what I thought was true about conventional farming and organic farming. And as I started taking the classes in chemistry and soil science and the different science that kind of underlied these kinds of beliefs that I had, I was really surprised to discover that some of my fundamentalist ideas about organic farming and conventional farming, there was no scientific evidence to support it. And you know, in fact, some of the beliefs I carried, the opposite was true. So I realized that I had a tendency to generalize and then to hold my generalizations as being true and then, you know, get on a bandwagon and kind of try to convince everyone else it was true and, you know, kind of be a burden on people in general kind of way. And so when I got involved in Buddhism, this history of mine remained with me. And as a generalization, I think religious people make a lot of generalizations. The world of religion is filled with it, I believe. People generalize and have fundamentalist ideas and hold them to be true. And occasionally religious people burden other people with their ideas. It's been known to happen. And so I was very interested in, you know, looking, you know, staying awake and attentive to where do I generalize, where are the generalizations, not to fall into that. I still fall into that, but at least I'm interested in understanding it and exploring it. That's one. The other is I became also, because of my experience at San Francisco Zen Center and my early years of, still to this day, my years of Buddhist practice, I became aware of how there are often underlying assumptions about the spiritual life, the religious life, the practice life, that were also kind of a burden, that often cause suffering for me and for other people. One of them, I was one of those people who thought I was supposed to be like one, there was one of the priests in Zen Center who I wanted to be like. And I thought that was the whole point of Zen practice, is to be like him. And then I left Zen Center for a year, and I came back a year later and met other teachers there, and they were a lot different from him, radically different from him. I thought, this is weird. Why aren't they like him? And I realized the point isn't to be like that person, but the point is to let it unfold in your own personality, in your own life, and not to mold yourself in some personality way like someone else. One of the assumptions at the Zen Center back in the late 70s, early 80s, was a little bit cultic, was true Buddhism only exists at San Francisco Zen Center. And occasionally there were people who left Zen Center to go practice at other Buddhist centers in America or in Asia, and we felt sorry for them. You know, it wasn't really where the truth was. You know, it was kind of like a little bit off. And so that's a kind of assumption that was built into the kind of system there. Another assumption was, if you really understood Zen, if you really understood the deep teachings of emptiness, you wouldn't have any questions. And since you're supposed to look good as a Zen student, you know, you want to be a good Zen student, so therefore you wouldn't have any questions. So when time came for questions, you know, anybody have any questions? No one had any questions because, you know, that would let on that you didn't know. And if you didn't know, then you weren't a good Zen student. Well, you're wasting your time. So there were assumptions built into the system. So on one hand, there were people, we generalize, and I became sensitive to that tendency. The issue of assumptions, I became sensitive to that issue. And the third issue, which is a little bit more difficult to kind of give you an example for, should be easier, I think, but that kind of makes sense, but is I'm very also interested in the topic of the beliefs that we hold. Are there consequences for holding those beliefs that go beyond the immediate, obvious domain of that belief system? So, for example, if you have some religious belief, you hold some spiritual belief or belief about life, does it have sociological consequences in the your involvement with the community and how you see other people? So, for example, one of the teachings at Zen Center was the teaching of emptiness. If you saw the emptiness of things, that was the real point of it. And so people didn't really address and talk about their anger, for example, at Zen Center, because you see the emptiness of it. And if you understood the emptiness of it, then there was no need to talk about it. And if you had it, then you didn't see the emptiness of things, so you didn't want to show that. So there's a whole kind of shadow side of anger that then spilt over into the kind of the way the community related to each other, kind of undercurrent sometimes of kind of that. I don't know if that was a good example, but the best example I can maybe give you is from my dissertation when I wrote a dissertation on early Mahayana Buddhism. I wrote a dissertation on a particular text called The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, very early Mahayana discourse. And it's considered to be the kind of like the prime expression of the Mahayana philosophy of emptiness. Very important kind of fundamental teachings of emptiness in Mahayana tradition. And there also, kind of like Zen Center, over and over again this text wants to emphasize everything is empty. Some kind of, that nothing has, things don't have an abiding character, essence. And if you understand the impermanence, the conditioned nature of things, that they are impermanent, they're empty in their core, then you can be liberated. And it's a very profound and interesting philosophy. But this text, in holding this philosophy, did awake entirely with earlier Buddhist teachings on human psychology. And early Buddhism had a very sophisticated teaching on how the mind works and the factors of the mind and the causal relationship between things in the mind, cause and effect relationship. This early Mahayana book had virtually no teachings about causality, how things, one thing causes or conditions something else. They just said that everything's empty. That's what you have to understand. They almost like they wanted to deny or push away causality as being belonging to kind of a superficial realm of reality. Just go down to the essence, which is everything's empty. One of the consequences of this, and that you see in the text, is that this text, which is considered to be a text of great philosophy, and most people don't kind of gloss over that part of the text which is not philosophical. There's a lot of it. The causal world has to be explained somehow or other for human beings. And the way they did it was to sit, not by reference to human psychology and causal connections there, but the progress in your practice, or if you kind of backslid in your practice, was attributed to the great kind of celestial cosmic battle between Buddha and Mara. Mara's the Buddhist devil. And somehow you are players, you know, and your practice was affected by this mythological world. So in focusing on the great philosophy of emptiness, somehow or other they opened the doors for this mythic explanation of causality, which was mostly absent in that kind of way in the earlier tradition. And that has then this whole mythology became a central part of the tradition. So the belief of emptiness, which is very profound, had other consequences beyond the actual belief itself. And so the generalizations, the assumptions, and the consequences involved in their beliefs is something which I'm very interested in exploring and understanding. And part of the delight in doing this, I think, comes a little bit maybe from my Zen training, my understanding of Buddhism. And that is that it's really great to have the rug pulled from under your beliefs. Because if you really want to be free, you don't want to have, you don't want to be clinging or holding to any beliefs at all. Clinging to them, you can have general kind of orient understandings that you orient your life by, but to have your beliefs pulled away from under you is really great. And that's kind of like a Zen thing. You don't stand anywhere. So that's I really delight in this. Where other people are terrified not to have a belief, not to hold on to some point of view. So we'll talk more about this next week. And if you have any, you know, if you want to point out how I've made terrible generalizations, assumptions, and consequences in what I've said so far, you can tell me next week.